You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 131 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello! It feels like it's been a long time.
It has.
A lot has happened.
A lot has happened. Should we get into it?
We should get right into it, and we are going to need... We're actually pouring one out this week. I don't know why my tone is so chipper right now, but...
We're pouring two out, as a matter of fact.
Wow. So what we have here to drink is what I like to call a beers that were in my fridge.
I had a beer, but I forgot to bring it.
From 10 Barrel Brewing Company, the Coast Trip Guava's Gone Wild. It's a cream ale brewed with guava.
I had that a couple weeks ago. I thought that was quite good. That was when we were carving pumpkins, including the Talkin' Taco Time pumpkin carved by Mrs. Fantasy Genius, which you may have seen on Instagram if you follow us there. And if you don't, why not? Also on Twitter, but I'm just promoting the Instagram right now.
And?
All right. Weirdly, we've flipped what we're actually going to drink here, but have here the Black Butte Porter from Deschutes Brewery. Let's see, there is no description. I guess there's a profile here. Notes of rich chocolate and coffee, a luscious creaminess, and a roasted finish in the classic Deschutes Black Butte Porter.
All right, those were beers that were in my fridge.
I mean, they're quality beers.
The Black Butte Porter is in at least 60% of fridges.
That checks out. That sounds about right. All right, yes, we're remembering a couple of people who have passed away since we last podcasted. First up, Jack Patera, the Seahawks inaugural coach who died last Wednesday at age 85 of complications from pancreatic cancer. Patera coached the Seahawks for their first 6-plus seasons of existence and was named the NFL Coach of the Year in 1978, their third year by the Associated Press and Sporting News, after the Seahawks went 9-7 that season, just missing out on the playoffs.
My favorite thing about that nugget is that he's not that much older than Pete Carroll is right now.
He's substantially older than Pete Carroll, but it's actually kind of a fascinating story. After he was fired by the Seahawks, he never took another coaching job and retired, I want to say, near Cleella, I believe, is where he lived out his remaining years. So kind of a short-lived NFL career, but still one that made an impact on Seahawks history. All right, also, we have to pour one out for a friend of a friend of the family. A noted Italian in the South Seattle area. You know him as the namesake of the Mario Brothers. Mario Segale, a landowner, businessman in the South Seattle area who happened to rent out a warehouse to Nintendo of America when they first began their operations in, I think that was Kent, technically, not Tequila, but one of those two places near South Center.
Mario.
He died a week ago Saturday at age 85. So
we definitely pour one out. One of the best nuggets is A, that Mario is named after a real person, and that B, we sort of know that person.
Yes. I think I first learned about it. Art Thiel wrote a book about Mariners history, and he referenced this in the context of talking about Nintendo of America buying the Mariners, or like facilitating the purchase of the Mariners in whatever year that was that happened. What, 91, I guess? 91 or 92? Yeah, that's where I first discovered it. And yes, we know the Segale family did not ever meet Mario Segale. We didn't know him specifically, but knew people he was related to.
The Segales that we know, it's the same Segales, though.
Yes.
Okay.
They're like cousins or something.
I was going to say, I was telling the famous cousin Katie yesterday, I was like, I have a Segale car.
That's accurate.
Yes. My car was bought from a Segale.
That is true.
So, you know, pretty close relation. And also, namesake for Mario. So
I mean, that's quite a tombstone right there. I doubt that would actually go on his grave, but it would be quite a thing to do, to have on there. All right. Should we move on and talk about sports?
Absolutely, we should.
Okay. I wanted to start by discussing my trip to Portland last week.
Okay.
Because it was jam-packed with sports. The Blazers this year have a couple of stretches in the schedule where they play back-to-back games at home. And I don't think anyone else is excited about this because of the fact that like you'd like a little bit of a break, especially on a weekend where they play both Saturday and Sunday, except me, because it's one trip down there where I can see two games. And then conveniently, it worked out on top of that. we didn't know when we last recorded this podcast who the Seattle Sounders would play in the MLS Cup playoffs. And then it turned out they played Portland, and they played them on Sunday afternoon. So I was able to go to the Sounders-Timbers playoff match before going to the Blazers-Wolves game on Sunday night that completed the back-to-back. First up, though, was Blazers-Lakers. And the second visit by the Lakers to Portland in the first 2.5 weeks of the season.
All the visits.
That's all. That is all the visits. Unless they play each other in the playoffs, which seems slightly more plausible now than it did at the start of the season, actually, because it looks like Portland will probably has a decent shot at home court advantage in the first round.
Okay. Let's talk about the Blazers in a second.
All right.
But jam-packed weekend of sports in the entire Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I mean, there was also both a Husky game that I missed on Saturday night and then Seahawks game against the Chargers on Sunday. So there was a lot going on.
Okay, so what happened in your... Let's start with the Blazers, I guess, because that's what you went to first. So Friday night, the rematch with LeBron and the Lakers. Blazers took round one on opening night. What happened in this one?
Yeah, the Lakers kind of ran away with it. They were up 20 at one point in the fourth quarter, early in the fourth quarter. Blazers did stage a late comeback. I think got about as close as four down the stretch, but had a missed goaltend go against them in the late stages and just couldn't quite get back into that. And basically a game that make or miss league in the NBA. They missed a ton of threes. It was their lowest three-point percentage since the, I think, calendar 2016.
Really?
Yeah. So I was pretty impressed by the Lakers with that game. Then they turned around the next night on their own back-to-back and gave up 41 points in the first quarter to the Raptors and trailed by 31 after one quarter or at one point in that first quarter.
The Raptors made regression to the mean work for them.
And I was less impressed by the Lakers at that point. They remain a flawed team, if one that's entertaining to watch, because of the fact that they don't play much defense and are entertaining on offense.
Do any teams play much defense?
Yeah, the Grizzlies. Okay. Also the Grizzlies. Second night of the back-to-back, sticking with the Blazers, Minnesota came in. Jimmy Butler did not play, as we found out that morning at shoot-around. Derrick Rose also sat out that game, so they only had one real point guard on the roster in Tyus Jones, and Minnesota got summarily destroyed by 30-plus by the Blazers. I also saw a third Blazers game on Tuesday night against Milwaukee. Their most impressive win of the three as they knocked off a Bucks team that had only lost once to that point and did so pretty comfortably.
This is how we do it. I mean, huge win for the Blazers from the very beginning of the season. All of the pundits, present company included, were saying that the Blazers would not make the playoffs.
I picked the Blazers to make the playoffs. I picked them in eighth. Just as I did in 2017-18 as well.
And over and over again. People predict that the Blazers were going to regress, that this core of a team can't remain. And every single year, the Blazers continue to be good. They're currently sitting...
Let's not go too far.
They're currently sitting at 8-3 with an excellent point differential. Third in the West, a game and a half up for the third seed. I mean, the season is happening. This is not a small sample size.
No, it's still a small sample size.
But we're like...
It's not a tiny sample size.
It's not a tiny sample size. The Blazers are a good team. There's a very... What are the chances the Blazers finish with home court advantage?
I mean, off the top of my head, I would say slightly better than 50-50. I mean, there's a lot of teams in the mix, so I don't know that any one team besides the Warriors is that overwhelmingly likely to have home court advantage, but... They've put themselves in position. They're playing, and the biggest story of the season to me so far, I mean, Nick Stauskas has been great. Just the entire second unit. Evan Turner.
The Blazers are exceptionally good at finding players like this.
They are very good at that, yes. Stotts' system empowers them.
Yeah, maybe it's Terry Stotts' system. I was going to say, I don't know if I should give Neil Olshey credit necessarily, because it feels like...
It's a little of both. I mean, Stauskas, like, in hindsight, was like the perfect player for that system, but also it seemed like he was perfect for the Brooklyn system last year.
I thought it was going to be Seth Curry, but it turned out it was Nick Stauskas.
And Seth Curry is still playing an important role. But what they've done is they've put these two shooters in the backcourt and then put the ball in Evan Turner's hands. Much more similar to how he played in Boston when he was reasonably successful there, as compared to the last two seasons where the Blazers tried to play him a lot with Lillard and McCollum. And they, in the past, kept one of Lillard and McCollum on the court at all times. Now they're playing those two guys together a bunch, which means when they're on the court at the end of the first quarter and the other team has their bench in, the Blazers have an edge there. But then also the second unit has been really good. And the linchpin of it, we've talked about other players. Zach Collins makes every shot he takes now.
Yeah.
He has developed into a dominant shot blocker. He's kind of like what I thought he might be going into the draft, where I had him ranked as a pretty high prospect.
There is no player who I would have expected to be a bust. Wait, who's that guy that Detroit drafted who's like...
Henry Ellenson?
No.
Luke Kennard?
Yeah, Luke Kennard. That guy's terrible, right?
No, he's good.
Is he really good?
Yeah, man, fine.
What is going on? My bust predictor radar or whatever is off.
I notice a commonality among the players you predict to be bust. Can't put my finger on it. Something there.
But still, it's just like I was not expecting Zach Collins to be that impactful of a player. And now
he held his own as a rookie, but he was really inefficient and just didn't do a lot. So he rated poorly by advanced metrics, and now he rates amazing by advanced
does
metrics.
He?
And that usually doesn't happen.
I mean, he's kind of the core of the next generation of Blazer.
Yes.
And they've been able to do this consistently over and over and over again for like 12 plus years. Basically, continue to find the next star.
Yeah, I suppose so. Next star is still a little strong, but very encouraging signs from Zach Collins so far during his second season.
Every year people want to write the Blazers off, but they don't go away. And credit also to Terry Stotts.
Absolutely.
Has to be one of the best coaches in the NBA.
Yeah. For sure. All right, so I don't know if we want to talk about the Sounders Timbers experience right now or save that for the MLS Cup playoff section or just do that section. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Let's just talk about it now.
Okay. So Sunday afternoon, first off, I watched like the first quarter of the Seahawks game.
You should have just stopped after the first drive.
Sadly, I missed the first drive because I was like sitting in the wrong place to see the TV that they had turned to the Seahawks game at my request. I was like had my Sounders hoodie under my shirt because I was trying to avoid detection in this bar that was completely filled with Timbers fans. It turns out in hindsight, I probably needn't have worried. Like I wore the Sounders hoodie on the max back from the stadium over towards the Moda Center. And no one said, said anything.
I mean, like
it's true. It was a happier mood for
quite a bit lower at that point.
I actually had Sounders fans sit behind me on the max and we talked about the game. So it turned out to be a lower stress environment than I perhaps was expecting in this heated derby that exists between the two teams.
What was the atmosphere like though? Because it's only the second time that the Sounders and the Timbers have met each other in the playoffs, right?
It was interesting. I didn't consume Portland as much as I was expecting. Like people weren't buzzing about the fact that the Sounders and Timbers were playing in the playoffs. And I expected it to be a bigger deal. The atmosphere in the actual match... It's a little odd because it's an old baseball stadium that they play in Providence Park, and they've like redone a lot of it. They're working currently on renovating one of the stands right now. But the section where they sit the visiting supporters naturally is like the worst part of the stadium. Mm-hmm. And it's like,
good for them.
You're in the far corner right up against, not having been there, you may struggle to understand this. It's up against like an athletic club, which I think they may have originally built the park to go along with it, like back.
It was built for that Portlandy episode.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like 100 years earlier.
Is it like a 100-year-old baseball stadium?
It's very old.
Wow.
Yeah. I doubt that the bleachers we were in were quite that old, but they were definitely pretty old. And so you don't get a good feel for the rest of the stadium because of the fact that you're so far removed from the Timbers supporters, understandably so. But like you couldn't hear their chants really or anything, just knew that they were cheering.
Is this your first time there?
Yeah. I've been to the actual stadium once. There was an MLS like All-Star Futures game mm-hmm. that I went to like 30 minutes of before a Men in Blazers concert in Portland. That was the actual reason I was there, but a friend had free tickets to that game. So we went briefly beforehand. The atmosphere started off, like, the emotion started off running really hot for Sounders fans because, first off, they had what looked like it could be a penalty in, like, the first 10 minutes of the match where the Timbers goalkeeper, Jeff Antonella, came out on Christian Roldan and appeared to foul him. Nothing was called on the field. They went to VAR, and the referee went over and checked it out and then still called nothing. And it just ended up being a corner kick for the Sounders. But... minutes later, they did get on the board first with a Raul Ruiz Diaz goal, his 14th of the season for the Sounders, as he continues his incredible hot streak. But the elation of the supporters was short-lived because the Timbers equalized through Jeremy Ibobise, breakaway goal 7 minutes later. And right around then was when Roldan started struggling with an injury that he had suffered when he was tackled in the box. He tried to continue but was unable. And with him on the sidelines, as the Sounders were waiting to sub on Waylon Francis, deciding who to sub on in his place, Portland scores a second goal to go up 2-1. And at that point, things are looking pretty bleak. Roldan's off the field. Like, your most reliable player has missed only 7 minutes in the entire MLS regular season.
That's really unbelievable.
Yes. And then Chad Marshall comes up with a non-contact injury.
That was really
not long
one.
After that. We all assumed that he had like torn his ACL or something. It fortunately wasn't quite that bad, but not good. He gets stretchered off. And now all of a sudden, these Sounders are down two starters and a goal before halftime of the first match of this first leg. It looked like it could be really horrendous. It was pretty quiet in the supporters section at halftime, I have to say. But the Sounders did recover. I think they actually really had the better of play in the second half of this match, probably had more dangerous goal-scoring opportunities than Portland did. Timbers didn't try or weren't able to press forward to score additional goals against the weakened Sounders after they kind of regrouped at halftime. And I feel like ultimately, you know, going this match finishing 2-1, you know, with Portland winning, but the Sounders getting the road goal, a pretty good result, all things considered, for the Sounders, given everything that went wrong in the first 25 minutes or so.
There are a lot of worse outcomes.
Yes.
Than 2-1. So they come back to Seattle needing either a 1-0 victory, or if Portland scores, all of a sudden the ability to win becomes that much harder.
Yeah, then they need to win by at least two goals if Portland gets it. A 2-1 scoreline would then send it to extra time, since both teams would have the one road goal. But other than that, Sounders would need to win in regulation. The Sounders would need to win by at least two goals. So,
and then, what is the status for Roldan and Chad Marshall heading into that match, which takes place tonight on Thursday night?
Yeah, Thursday night, because of the car show this weekend, International Audio Show.
Good news for having two very key players be injured.
I know. It seemed like an advantage for the Sounders at first. Like, Timbers fans were complaining about it when I was at the Uno Mas Taquiza eating their tacos for the second time this year before this match.
Nice.
But then with the injuries, all of a sudden it seems now like an advantage for Portland. Either way, Chad Marshall was not going to be playing. He underwent meniscus surgery on Tuesday and is presumably, even for the length of the extremely long MLS Cup playoffs, done for those at this point, you would assume. Roldan, day-to-day. Brian Schmetzer said on Wednesday that he will be a game time decision for this match. And, the good news with Marshall is that in Roman Torres, the Sounders have a really experienced center back to come into the lineup, with Kim Keehee replacing Torres in the starting lineup. This is somebody who was there the last 2 years as the Sounders marched to the MLS Cup, scored the winning penalty kick in the MLS Cup that they won at Toronto. You feel pretty comfortable with him. Roldan's the more difficult player to replace. They went with Francis, who's a defender by trade.
Chad Marshall.
No, Chad Marshall's awesome. But
such an anchoring force on the defense that Roman Torres is maybe a little bit more prone to errors than Chad Marshall might be.
But the back line looked solid in the second half. And again, like, relative to in the past when Chad Marshall has been injured and they've had to go to, you know, really inexperienced players or play someone out of position with Gustav Svensson in the back line. Like, now you've got two starting caliber players there still, even with Chad Marshall out. Roldan, a little more tricky to figure out who's going to replace him. They went with Francis, who's a defender by trade. He did, you know, probably help slow down the Portland counterattack, I would say, having him out there. But he wasn't really providing you the kind of quality in terms of connecting passes and keeping possession that you would like in a midfielder and get from Christian Roldan. And I would expect to see a more offensive attacking choice for the Sounders in this one, with them absolutely needing a goal to get through no matter what. Harry Shipp is one possibility. He's maybe not quite 100%. He came on at the end of this match actually as a sub for Francis. They used their third sub on subbing off a sub, which is unusual.
It was a sub.
And obviously your tactical flexibility was limited because of having to use two subs on injuries. That'll be something the Sounders will actually have the ability to maybe play around with a little bit more on Thursday night. I think there's a decent chance we see Hanwala Buana in that role to give the Sounders some speed coming up the flank. He's been effective at times, played a key role against San Jose in the last game of the regular season coming on as a substitute. So it'll be really interesting to see what Brian Schmetzer does strategically. I think people will be very disappointed if they see Waylon Francis again in the starting, well, in the starting 11 for the first time, but again as Roldan's replacement if he's unable to go.
Yeah, it's just interesting strategy-wise going into this game because, I mean, Portland, you don't want to play too defensive in the situation because if they're playing too defensive and a goal gets through, then all of a sudden they have to change the game plan completely. But it's kind of just like the way that you imagine like the defensiveness of each team where it's like Portland's going to come out and be very defensive.
And that's the style they like to play. They don't want to possess the ball. They want to play a counter-attacking style. So they'll sit back and play for a goal on the counter.
But then if the Sounders score a goal, then they'll be playing very defensive.
Yes.
Because looking for that 1-0 outcome. And I would say, if you were to predict the most likely score in this match...
You think it's 1-0?
I think it's 1-0.
Okay. Do you want to talk about chances of victory?
I still think they're better than 50% for the Sounders.
So 538 Soccer Power Index said 47% after the 2-1 loss, down from 55% beforehand, which shows that it's not a devastating loss, especially because you got that road goal. It's not a good result necessarily, but it could have been a lot worse.
It limits the routes to victory.
Yes. You can't get through with a draw, and you need to score a goal.
But let's say that they score a goal early and can pick up a second goal at some point. Then all of a sudden they can play pretty loose or play very defensive. I think I still feel pretty confident in them advancing.
I think 50-50 is probably pretty reasonable. I mean, maybe we should adjust downward a little bit for the injuries. And maybe even the 47% is generous. But, I feel like the Sounders still are probably a better team than Soccer Power Index indicates based on what they've done with Royal Rui Diaz in the lineup.
And you're expecting Roldan not to...
I'm going to go in not expecting it and be pleasantly surprised if he does.
The first match that they play the entire season that Christian Roldan won't be starting.
I assume he didn't start in the U.S. Open Cup matchup. I think that's probably the one time he didn't start all year.
Is the most important match that they'll be playing all year.
That would be a bummer.
Wow.
Not great.
And now that Ladero's dyed his hair, it's almost like he's a different person.
I felt it was nice because it was easier to follow him. By the way, my big takeaway from being in the visiting supporters section is that those flags, like very hard to actually see the game with flags, a bunch of flags in front of you waving constantly back and forth. It really is prioritizing like showing visible support over actually allowing people to watch the match.
This is what soccer is?
Yep. Supporters section talk. That's what supporters section talk.
If the supporters section could all be like the person yelling, they would all be facing the wrong way.
All right, it's time for an unexpected return of an old friend.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Have you heard of the Woj bot? So there's a bot on Twitter that randomly makes up trades and other transactions and tweets them out every 15 minutes, all hours of the day or not, imitating Woj's breaking news tweet. And I have to assume that that's the same approach that Trader Jerry DePoto is taking with the Mariners. That's right. Trader Jerry is at it again. And in a beautiful twist, according to Ryan Divish, he's about to trade for a player the Mariners already both acquired and sent out in trade within the same day two off seasons ago. What? I have to give credit to Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, who said it was the chef's kiss of transactions after I concocted this. That's Tampa Bay outfielder Malik Smith. The M's got him for prospects and then traded him for Drew Smyly, who of course never pitched a game in Seattle after undergoing Tommy John surgery. Now they're apparently sending Mike Zunino and Guillermo Heredia to the Rays to get Smith back. I challenge you to prove to me that that's a real series of trades and not the result of a bot. It sounds like this is just the start of Trader Jerry's favorite time of the year. Divish reported on Tuesday that the M's want to infuse young talent and cut their bloated payroll, and that James Paxton would be traded. We can only hope that if and when that happens, it sounds more like a real trade than the work of Twitter randomness.
Wow. I just love when the takes are back. But the thing is, I was thinking about this, there's truth in the takes. And at the end of the year, we were talking about how the takes often were about how it would be an extended period of time just looking at this roster before the Mariners even sniffed a chance at the playoffs again.
Yes.
And this is them fully admitting that that's the truth.
If you trade James Paxton, you're going into a rebuild.
You're not going into a rebuild. You're going into a bottoming out. This is not... The Mariners have never really intentionally done this.
They've never Sixers it, despite
our many... I think they were still trying to... I mean, honestly, they're in the same division as the Astros. They see that this can work.
Yes. I mean, but also, they have no choice because they have so much payroll tied up in Cano and Felix.
What are they going to do? Oh, my God. It's going to be... They better have a hell of a game ops experience the next 3 years.
You're going to have to expand the size of the Diamond Club. John Heyman reported that the Yankees intend to hold on to Mitch Haniger, Edwin Diaz, and Marco Gonzalez, who recently signed a 2-year deal that takes him through his non-arbitration years. And word is, quote, everyone else is up for grabs.
They're going to have a lot of college nights. Just say. There may be a game where there's not a single person sitting in their seats at the baseball game.
We've gotten close in April previously.
But it is going to be a rough experience at the major league level watching the Mariners for ever.
I mean, it's already been 17 years, right?
It's almost the Bills made the playoffs. It's like, granted, nothing came of the Bills making the playoffs. They're still playing maybe the worst quarterback in NFL history, but they made the playoffs for that year. The Mariners are now bottoming out after doing nothing.
Yeah. It's like you see this sometimes in the NBA where teams like go for it and then they don't get it. And so you neither get the short-term benefit of going for it, but you still pay the long-term cost.
We'll always remember going June, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
what a time.
Huh, the takes were hot.
Bring back that 4th of July podcast where the Sounders season was over and the Mariners were making the playoffs.
Wow.
What a time.
Oh, my God. But again, Trader Jerry, I'll say.
Do you think he's excited? Kind of excited about it secretly?
Oh, he's excited.
But by the way, I kind of like this trade, actually. I mean, it's weird because of the fact that Trader Jerry usually
likes... Big Malik Smith guy? You're a big Malik Smith guy?
He had solid numbers this year.
Did he?
Yeah. He's young.
Okay.
I'm going to do it.
Sure.
I mean, the weird thing is that trading Zunino, usually like Jerry DePoto is trading four players coming off bad seasons because he does like to make regression to the mean work for him. In this case, you're trading Zunino off a down season, so it's a little bit questionable whether you're going to get value for him, but, you know.
If you make enough trades, you're going to win some of them.
It's true.
Trader Jerry is living proof of that, because the Mariners have had some straight swindles in the Trader Jerry era, but they went all in two seasons ago at the trade deadline, as has been oft-discussed in the Mariners' hot takes.
They traded away the entire minor league system, yes.
For unknown reasons, went all in. The only person
But they also saw this coming. They also saw that their two best, like their best players were all super old and expensive.
But then why do you trade all your youth?
Because you're like trying to actually get something out of those players while you can.
For 1 year?
Yeah.
We'll always have June.
2 years. They were trying to do it in 2017 too. It just didn't take.
But so now, not only is the major league roster very expensive and very old and not that good, but also they have no farm system.
That's why you got to start trading players.
The Mariners are in much the worst position.
I mean, Paxton should yield a pretty good return in terms of minor leaguers, right? You would assume.
Well, as far as value, players that you could get value for, Gene Segura, James Paxton. It was Edwin Diaz on the do not trade list.
He's on the do not trade list.
Closer, of all players.
Yeah, I agree.
Edwin Diaz is the number one player they should be trading. Like, I understand Mitch Haniger keeping him. And honestly, James Paxton, like, injuries are potential. It probably makes sense to trade James Paxton, despite the fact that I love him.
We'll always have the O Canada.
But this is not a good position to be in for the Mariners. And they better get They better hope they get quite a package back for James Paxton. Because other than that, there's not a lot of trade value there. Nelson Cruz is a free agent and is visiting other teams. Obviously, the Mariners not interested in bringing him back. And they're still paying both Felix and Robinson Cano. I mean, they're going to be paying Robinson Cano forever.
Well, good times.
The Mariners got to be involved in Jay-Z's finest moment as an agent, as a sports agent.
Until KD goes to the Knicks.
Well, he's not the sports agent for KD, right? Or is he still?
I mean, I think Rich Kleiman left, but I'm going to retroactively give KD credit because that's when he started, or Jay-Z credit because that's when he started working with Rich Kleiman.
All right.
I also don't actually think KD is going to the Knicks, but maybe. Who knows?
Man, we'll see. I was listening. Just thinking about the argument. Did you listen to Bill Simmons talking about that?
I did.
I think that was with Brian Windhorst.
Yes.
Where he's like, you would be, if you're Kevin Durant, you're going from one of the best run organizations in the league to the worst run organization in the league. And I was like, it totally checks out. If you play for a bad owner, the team's going to be bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all you have to say?
We'll see.
Like, I just don't. I don't think being in New York matters that much.
All right. Even though he started his career in here, we don't need to talk about KD. We've got too much Seattle sports continuing.
Next summer.
With is one door closes, another door opens, and that door is Husky men's basketball.
There we go.
Starting the season with a 73-55 win Tuesday over Western
what
Kentucky.
What door closed?
The Mariners' contention.
The Mariners' window.
Yeah.
That door's been closed.
Yeah, it has been closed. That's true. There was so after the high of the win at Nevada in an exhibition game, there was then the panic of the Huskies trailing SPU at halftime of their exhibition last week, which they ended up winning 70-61, and then again trailing at halftime against a pretty solid Western Kentucky team, but still one that the Huskies should have taken care of, especially because they were without one of their starters, DeShaun Murray, due to suspension, even though they did have five-star prospect Charles Bass, who had a double-double in his debut.
It's
but
a five-star prospect?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not get into what Western Kentucky's doing in terms of recruiting under Rick Stansbury, but yeah, they sure did get a five-star prospect after getting Mitchell Robinson last year, who didn't end up playing for them. That was too bad for them, because Mitchell Robinson is very good at basketball, it turns out.
And he's in the NBA now?
He plays for the Knicks. He's their starting center at
this point.
Was
he somebody who went to ING Academy or something? What happened?
He just didn't play last year.
Huh.
And ended up getting drafted in the second round. Yeah, so basically the Huskies in the first half of this game just... They were behind because of the fact that they couldn't make a three-pointer to save their lives. And then Western Kentucky was shooting better than you would expect from three-point range. And you were still fairly panicked, I think, at halftime of this game.
I was not panicked at all.
Were you?
No.
Okay.
What do you mean? I was not panicked. I was not panicked about basketball. No, I wasn't panicked about anything.
That's a good point. Good point. In the second half, then Western Kentucky went 0-of-3 from 3-point range. The three actually is way more impressive than anything else. Only giving up three attempts. UW went 3-of-7 and pulled away to win this game quite comfortably.
The second half. I mean, there was some nervousness, but the second half went exactly as I expected it to.
I'd say it went a little better than I expected it to. The Huskies ended up moving up substantially in the rankings. They were 46th coming or 45th coming into the
game. I like that Ken Pom is just like what we consider the rankings.
Oh, yeah.
In the rankings.
The AP? First off, the AP isn't doing game by game. They came in 45th. They moved up one spot with some of the adjustments after we talked to Ken Pomeroy on the podcast last week, and then moved up to 40th after the game last night. They're down to 45th.
All right. That's not bad. I mean, that's probably first or second in the Pac-12.
I don't know if there's any big takeaways from this game. Jalen Noel looked terrific. He's looked great pretty much throughout. He was the one source of offense the Huskies had in the exhibition against SPU, and their ball movement was a little bit questionable, I would say.
The takeaway was, and you saw this because you went to the SPU game, right?
I did, yes.
The takeaway was, it's amazing watching a Husky basketball team where you know who every single person is. It's just like all the names are familiar. And so seeing so many players coming back, it's something we haven't seen in a very long time.
No. I mean, and, you know, last year the core was pretty similar. But I think my other takeaway from the SPU game was there's a pretty dramatic drop-off when you get to the freshmen, and they're going to take an adjustment period to NCAA basketball.
That's great, because they were playing last year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they don't have to. That's barring injury, they don't have to. So the only freshman who played against Western Kentucky in the real opener was Brian Penn Johnson, who is going to get some minutes as a backup center with his size. You know, he's able to just be effective because of that, but probably won't play a ton. And I think actually, I think he was like a -7 in the 3 minutes he played against Western Kentucky in a game the Huskies ended up winning.
Did he play at the end of the first half?
Yes, he did. Okay. Noah Dickerson, I believe, was a +31 in terms of plus minus in this game. Noah Dickerson's really good, man.
Man.
Matisse Thybulle's really good.
Oh, my God. I mean, Matisse Thybulle's going to break some records this year.
He is. He didn't have very many steals. He didn't have one until the closing minutes after having 8 in the exhibition against SPU. Not that it would have counted, but one shy of Jason Hamilton's school record of 9 steals. We also did learn Percy Allen reported that among those freshmen, Nate Roberts is going to redshirt this season. He played a little bit against SPU as a backup big because of the fact that Hamir Wright missed that game. He was back in the lineup and played a reasonable amount against Western Kentucky.
Players like that, though, seeing them, and I'm like, oh, yeah, Hamir Wright.
Yeah, no, he's good.
Like, oh, Naz Carter. I'm like, hey, guys.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Old friends.
But things getting a little bit realer this weekend.
Yeah, in classic UW fashion, the Huskies going on the road to play Auburn. And a ranked Auburn team who comes in number 11 under their head coach, Bruce Pearl. They're 17th in the KenPom ratings, or at least they were preseason. I don't know where they...
We should hope that the fate of each of these teams' seasons goes differently than the Auburn and UW football teams.
Agreed. By the way, why is it a thing that... why can't I remember the name of Auburn?
Gus Malzahn.
He's returning as head coach. They've lost three games.
This is the SEC. I saw that, too, at the bottom.
Do we
it's like,
need to have a report on whether Chris Peterson's going to return this year?
If Chris Peterson were coaching in the SEC, that would be a maybe it's just because he said it. I don't know. Maybe losing three games at Auburn is so devastating. Their team has not been... I saw that too, and it's like, Jesus Christ, of course he's returning. Also, he just is the first year of like a 9-year contract.
Yeah. I mean, they did fire Gene Chizik like 2 years after they played in the national championship game.
I think there's probably more evidence that Gus Malzahn is actually a good coach.
They did it to bring back Gus Malzahn.
Yeah, the AD is like, if he would have been like, he's not coming back, he should have just taken a briefcase of $100 bills and set it ablaze at that press conference.
All right, so the Auburn basketball team, which we're going to focus on now, beat South Alabama by 43 points in their opener to move up four spots in the Pomeroy rankings to 13th. This is a team that last year went 26-8 and lost in the second round of the NCAA tournament as a fourth seed. They did lose two starters, both Deshaun Murray, who oddly transferred from the Huskies' second opponent to their first.
I was going to say, I've seen that name before.
Yeah, he didn't end up playing because of the fact that he was suspended after getting cited for marijuana possession last week. They also lost their leading scorer, Mustafa Heron, who transferred to St. John's, where he'll be immediately eligible. But they'll get back center Austin Wiley, who was ineligible in 2017-18, and then also eventually Daniel Purifoy, who will have to sit out the season's first 9 games due to suspension. Those players both sat out last year in connection with the indictment of former Auburn assistant Chuck Person and former Sonics legend Person.
Chuck Person was the bag man?
He was.
Dude, super wealthy, former NBA
player. I mean, he's not the bag man. He was on the staff, but he was the conduit.
And he was the fall guy. Like, how do you let that happen if you're Chuck Person? Just get out of basketball.
Yeah.
Man, let it be a just nameless person who had to take the fall for this. But anyway.
But Austin Wiley, who is an NBA prospect, would potentially be the second NBA prospect in as many games the Huskies play at center. He did not play in their season opener because of the fact that he is dealing with a foot injury suffered during preseason practice. Auburn, quote, hopeful that Wiley will return to the court for the game against the Huskies. So that'll be kind of a big swing in this one, whether they have their 6'11", very talented center who was quite effective as a freshman.
And we'll always have that 2002 playoff series that the Sonics played against the Spurs and Chuck Person featured prominently in.
Wrong playoff series. It was 2000 against the Jazz.
According
to a Frank Hughes report, Chuck Person checked himself into one of the games.
There we go.
And missed the final shot that would have been a tied game 5. And sent it to overtime.
That's Chuck Person probably checked himself into this investigation.
Well,
also.
He sure did. They probably wishes he didn't. besides Wiley, Auburn also adds Samir Dowdy, a transfer from VCU who sat out last season, but now will presumably play a starting role for them throughout this season. He did get the start and had 14 points in their season opener. They got 20 from Jared Harper, who I think is their leading returning, or no, Bryce Brown is their leading running scorer. This is a good team.
Bryce Brown is very highly recruited, right?
No, that's someone else you're thinking of.
Is that a running back from like Colorado in the 90s?
Not Colorado. Bryce Brown played for the Eagles. There's also a Bruce Brown who was highly recruited and played at Miami, but is now in the NBA.
Oh, maybe that's who I'm thinking.
That could be
your thinking.
Jared Harper had 20 points and 13 assists. A very impressive debut for him. Their point guard and leader. This is a good team. They are pretty undersized. Last year, they started Heron at power forward at 6'5", and it looks like they started a pretty similar small lineup in this one.
Sorry, that's Seahawk legend Bryce Brown to you.
No, I didn't even think of that. They started 6'7", Anthony McElmore, and 6'8", Chuma Okeke in the front court. So if Wiley doesn't go, they're going to give up a lot of size to Noah Dickerson. If he's going to be really important for them. And I think the Huskies want to try to get him in foul trouble if he does play. After the Huskies play this game, they'll be back home on Monday to face the University of San Diego, who won 20 games last season for the first time since 2008. They saw Coach Lamont Smith, a former Lorenzo Romar assistant, lose his job after an off-court incident late in the season. Assistant Sam Skoll took over, and the Toreros come into this season ranked number 133 in the KenPom rankings and talking about potentially making the NCAA tournament for the first time in a long period of time. We'll see if they can pull that off. They also moved up 14 spots in the ranking after beating Weber State by 17 at home in their opener on Tuesday night. This is a veteran team. They returned four senior starters, but I would say the player to watch for is 6'10" sophomore Yawen Masalki, a.k.a. the Big Squirrel, who was a prodigious shot blocker last year in limited action and also shot 64% on two-point attempts.
Big squirrel. Man, this is the type of game that...
Historically, the Romar teams always lost.
I was going to say in the Lorenzo Romar era, there was always one of these games, and this feels like it to me.
There's a few options
on the schedule. Like, I mean, losing to Auburn wouldn't count because that's a game that the Huskies probably should lose.
Definitely wouldn't count.
But this game against the Toreros, that's a Romar loss.
Oh, no.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, Mike Hopkins, in general, last year was able to avoid a lot of the devastating non-conference losses.
He sure was. I would say Eastern Washington, UC Santa Barbara, Cal State Fullerton, all candidates. Also, there's this
They're team, all candidates.
This is team the Huskies are playing early in the season that's really lowly ranked, Washington State.
That is not a candidate.
They are ranked, by the way, far worse than San Diego or Cal State Fullerton, and slightly behind UC Santa Barbara, but they are ahead of Eastern Washington, so they're solid number three in the state.
So Eastern's probably not that much of a concern. Anyway, the San Diego game, like Auburn, it would be a cherry on top. It would give the Huskies a so-called signature win early in the season, something that once we get to March, this Auburn game will matter. If they win. If they lose, it won't matter at all. It'll matter for Auburn, maybe.
It wouldn't hurt them, really. But, yeah, I mean, it could help them a lot.
I mean, that's why you play a game like this early in the season. Because if it's football, you can be affected for the whole year from it. If it's basketball and you lose, whatever.
It's also a great, like, test for them. They're going to play two really hard, two road games in the non-conference. The other one, of course, being Gonzaga. So they're going to be prepared. These are tougher games than they will play at any point during the Pac-12 season, both of them. But it's also, by the way, the right time to play Auburn because of the fact that they're getting Purifoy back from the suspension 9 games later. And like the stats won't necessarily be able to account for that. It'll look like they played the whole Auburn team, even though they didn't quite play the whole Auburn team.
Still going to be 5 players on the court.
Yes. There will be. It'll look like that'd be a really harsh suspension if they had to play 4-on-5, like soccer.
The whole Auburn team. You can
get a red carded.
I love that they're playing it. I love that they're taking the shot. If they win, it would be amazing. I mean, they'd be up into the top 15 range if that happened. Ken Pomeroy might even show the Pac-12 a little bit of respect.
I do wish we'd play a game like this at home. There's not really a marquee home game on the schedule. All their notable games this season in the non-conference are on the road or neutral site where they'll play Texas A&M and Minnesota in Vancouver, BC later this month.
Really?
Yeah. Inaugural tournament in Vancouver.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's close enough.
We'll see. Probably not.
You gotta go to the Coof.
There's also a neutral site game against Virginia Tech. So a lot of hard games on the non-conference schedule. None of them being played in Seattle.
I mean, isn't that kind of the way it typically is?
Yeah, I mean, obviously because of tournaments, yes. But you'd like to see like one of those games be played in Seattle at some point. I guess Gonzaga will next year. All right, should we talk Husky football?
We'll see what happens, I guess. I want to talk Husky women's basketball.
Oh, that's right.
I skipped over that. You know, we'll see what happens. And I think after this week, we will have a very good sense of this.
A much clearer picture, yeah. It's not like they're facing a bunch of weak non-conference opponents. I mean, already Western Kentucky is a pretty good non-conference opponent, even if somewhat limited.
If they win both of these games, me saying that it's a top 10, which granted, in the Pac-12, it feels like it's in the top 10 because there's just so many of these. You're just going to lose Pac-12 road games. That's what happens. There are Pac-12 refs. You can lose them. It's fine. But
are you claiming a victory if they're ranked in the top 10 at any point during the season, or do they have to like remain in the top 10 for a while?
any point. Yeah. One time if they sniff the top 10.
I'm still taking it.
If they get to 12, I'm claiming victory.
That math does not check out.
12 is the new 10.
Some Pelton Guest geography if ever I heard it.
But if they were to win both of these games, the chances of them being a confident tournament seem very light.
Yes.
If they split them and just beat San Diego, we feel fine. It probably doesn't what we think going in.
No.
But I like this as right off the bat as being kind of a barometer week.
But also they have got a game under their belts. It's not like UW playing at Auburn. I mean, Auburn in Atlanta to start the football season.
Yeah, it's not like UW playing at Auburn. It's more like UW playing at Auburn.
I meant in terms of the game number. UW women's basketball tipping off the season Thursday night against Cal State Fullerton, and then we'll host Northern Arizona on Sunday. Neither of those teams are any good. I think they won 8-7 games respectively in the 2017-18 season. The Huskies will return four of their five starters from last season, led by Amber Melgoza, who averaged 19 points per game in a breakout sophomore campaign for a team that finished last in the Pac-12. The Huskies did see freshman guard Kiara Collier transfer, and they also lost Natalie Romeo and Deja Strother, neither of whom played last season, but officially medically retired after sitting those out. So in terms of adding depth to the core of returning players, the Huskies will be counting on three freshmen to give them more depth than they had last season when they were really, really battered by injuries in the first year for Coach Jody Wynn and her staff. So I think the expectations are still pretty modest. I think they were still last in the Pac-12 women's basketball preseason poll, but more competitive than we saw last season, I would say. So we'll check in. We'll find out more about them. They've also got some bigger games coming later in non-conference. But now to Husky football, coming off a 27-23 win on Saturday against Stanford, heading into this weekend's well-timed Week 10 bye.
I think the Huskies need this bye more than anybody could Week 11 bye.
Like mentally or physically?
Both. More mentally than physically, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they got healthy. They got both Miles Gaskin and Hunter Bryant last week, and that's probably, I mean, I guess the secondary, they have had some injuries with, Jordan Miller sitting out another game. Miles Bryant has been out, and then they also played the second half of this one against Stanford without starting safety JoJo McIntosh after a targeting injection that was accurately called, I would say. And Stanford did complete a lot of passes after halftime, but the first half was dominated by the Huskies, who got out to an early 21-0 lead in this game. It was looking kind of like, offensively, it was looking like we predicted, and defensively going better, I think, than we expected at the half.
Yeah, in the end, if you average both of them out, they probably looked more or less like how we expected the game.
Well, Stanford ended up having the better of yards per play in this game. But I think people who are like freaking out about this, number one, first off, like this idea that the Huskies like narrowly held on because Stanford had the ball with a chance to win. At no point in that final drive did Stanford's win probability, according to ESPN, ever get above 12%.
Still, it was scary.
It was scary, but it's scary in the way that things are scary irrationally. 12% is not that high. Like, the Huskies were always in control of this game.
Yeah. What did the Seahawks win probability get to at the end of Sunday's game?
At the end of Sunday's game? Oh, it never got very high at all. We're going to discuss that in a moment, actually.
Okay.
So I think people are being too harsh on the Huskies about this game, partially because of the fact that they decided to start running clock, it felt like, midway through the third quarter.
I mean, are we going to go through these topics here? Because I've got a lot of thoughts on a lot of things.
All right, let's start with Miles Gaskin's return. He had 28 carries for 148 yards. Really was the bell cow back for the Huskies in this one. And I would say your take that the Huskies would have beaten Cal had Miles Gaskin played, it aged well.
I mean, who knows? You can't tell. Like, the difference between Stanford's defense and Cal's defense is pretty significant. Miles Gaskin...
Are we giving Cal's defense some respect now after they completely shut down Wazoo for nearly that entire game?
We were always giving Cal's defense some respect.
I was about the royal we. Like, the world we. The Chris Peterson we.
I mean, honestly, we're probably not. The royal we is probably not. They just saw that Wazoo won. That game ended at, like, 11:30.
That's true. It was very late.
But Miles Gaskin wouldn't have run, it wouldn't have had 148 yards on 28 carries against Cal. But I still think having Miles Gaskin in there matters.
Yeah. He would have had positive yardage, which would have been better than Savon Hockman.
He's a steadying player, having Myles Gaskin out there. Myles Gaskin is an important player to be on the field for the Huskies.
Hunter Bryant, it turned out in this game, his first back, was not an important player
his
to have on
the field.
First
game back, one game into the offense.
One catch for 9 yards. It'll be interesting to see whether he plays against Oregon State, because if you are concerned about preserving Hunter Bryant's redshirt year, and you think there's a possibility you're going to play in the Pac-12 championship game, then that would potentially take him up to 5 games, including a bowl game this year, and therefore burn the season of eligibility. Whereas if he only plays in 4 games, he can potentially redshirt. Also, I'm not sure if Hunter Bryant's going to be around for 5 years to make this matter. I'm kind of skeptical on that one.
That's an interesting thought, though.
Actually, I'm fascinated to see what the decision is. Can I give you a take?
Yes.
Hunter Bryant should not play tight end for the Huskies this season.
Really?
Because Hunter Bryant should play wide receiver for the Huskies, where they are much more in need of depth than they are at tight end, where Kate Otten and Drew Sample have been really quite good at that position. And also, I think Hunter Bryant actually just is a wide receiver. Okay. That's my take.
I mean, he's definitely a more modern NFL wide receiver. He's like an Evan Engram, Jimmy Graham type. Right, he could play outside almost any down.
Yep.
I don't know the difference between the two is whatever. Like,
I mean, yes, it doesn't really ultimately matter, but I would think of him in terms of playing time, like maybe a little less Terrell Bynum and a little more Hunter Bryant, and not taking Kate Otten and Drew Sample off the field because they're playing well.
Yeah, I like that.
Are we concerned about the secondary at all?
No.
So the first half of this game, KJ Costello goes 13 of 20 for just 87 yards. It's like the most classic Huskies bend but don't break defense as they pitch a shutout for the first half of this game. In the second half, he had a lot of success underneath with the Huskies playing his off zone, but also was able to complete some big plays to not even with JJ Arcega-Whiteside out of the lineup. To Caden Smith, a tight end, and some of their other wide receivers, 14 of 20 for 205 yards, 10-plus yards per attempt in the second half of this game against a team that rarely allows that many.
Let me just be Stanford guy for a second. Can I be on a Stanford podcast? Why isn't that the entire offense? Why is that not the offense? No Stanford person has ever been this angry about anything. Why is that not the offense from the very beginning of the game? Why are you handing the ball off to Bryce Love? What are you doing? Come on, David Shaw.
I don't know why Stanford guy has like a San Diego accent. Come on, bro. What are you doing?
The reason it looked good, here are two reasons why the Stanford offense looked so good in the second half. It's A, they were running good offense, which Stanford rarely does. Maybe this year they do a little bit more.
A little more.
Historically, rarely does. And B, KJ Costello is the best quarterback in the Pac-12.
No.
It's not even close.
I'm not going to argue on
that. We have watched now. I mean, we haven't played against Gardner Minshew. I've seen a lot of Gardner Minshew.
I mean, he's a really good quarterback, but I do think KJ Costello is
overrated.
I mean, you can't say he's a product of the system when everyone else in that system actually had terrible advanced stats and he has great advanced stats.
He's actually the only good player. KJ Costello is an excellent quarterback, though. I mean, see, if you were to tell me just from watching the games who the expected first round pick would be between Justin Herbert and KJ Costello, it's not even close.
Yeah.
Like, Justin Herbert is a seemingly inaccurate quarterback, not a great decision maker. KJ Costello does everything right. He is the most terrifying quarterback in the Pac-12. He's the Philip Rivers of quarterbacks.
We'll get to that in a second here. Do we want to talk about the Huskies' second half offense?
This is the real issue.
There were a lot of predictable run pass. It wasn't actually, like, the ratio of run to pass actually wasn't as different between the two halves as I was expected. They ran a lot in the first half, too. But 19 runs to 12 passes in the second half.
It's just about what people are expecting, though. Just, I hate offense, and this is not how you run offense. Where you show up to the offensive line, and you tell them what you're going to do. That's not how offense works.
That's how you empower your offensive linemen.
When they were talking, like, I think one of the narratives that the broadcast was having is like, Husky's not getting as much of a push in the second half or whatever. It's like, that's such a bullshit thing to say. It's what it means is Stanford knows what's coming in the second half. There's no difference between the two. I'm sure that if you were able to judge the push, it would look pretty much the same. But when you know what's coming and when you're running the ball and then passing on third down, that's bad offense.
I just hate the run pass so much.
There's no element of surprise there. And that's been the thing that's been missing from this Husky offense all season long. Like, I was watching on Sunday night the Patriots-Packers game. And the Patriots, they were doing some things. I mean, that play where they passed. Have you seen this play?
I did not see any of that game, really.
Where Tom Brady passed it to Justin Edelman. Julian Edelman, too. Tom Brady passes it to Julian Edelman. Edelman turns back, and you think, oh, like maybe he's going to pass it back to Brady or something. But actually, he's setting up a screen pass, and it's back to James White, who's going down the field.
Oh, that's something.
Ugh, it was such a well-run play. And it's just like, hey, Bush Hamden, try something, anything. Open up the playbook the slightest bit, because they have not done any of that this season. And it's like, if you're going to do that, maybe the year where you have a senior running back and a senior quarterback should be the time to do it.
I think that decision probably comes higher than Bush Hamden.
He's just, yeah, Chris Peterson's there just being like, no trick plays. But in the second half,
he's just so annoyed that he gets known for trick plays. It like bothers him so much.
In the second half, the offense just was like, it was so vanilla.
Yes.
And it was so predictable. And that's why Stanford shut them down.
Do you want to talk quickly about the decision not to go for fourth and one and to punt instead to Stanford ahead of Stanford's final drive, which ended with an interception in the end zone? That was Taylor Rapp, right?
I think that was Taylor Rapp. I like Ty Jones being in the offense. He's like the Julio Jones of...
Yeah, that was good. Third Pelton brother Mike B was definitely incensed about the decision not to go for it on Twitter. I got to say, I don't really have an issue with not going for it on that spot.
I mean, they should have gone for it.
I don't think they should have. Because, I mean, looking at the win probability, it didn't seem to change at all based on the decision to punt. I think if it had been a three-point game, I would have felt differently about it because Stanford would have been so easily able to get into field goal range. But because of the fact that they needed a touchdown, that's, I think, why their win probability never got very high in that final drive. I mean, two minutes was a lot of time, but it also wasn't a lot of time in college because the substitution rule and the Huskies milked that beautifully.
Well, and also there was a first down that they definitely did not stop the clock.
No, they stopped it, but then you restart it when it's ready to play.
The second first down, they didn't stop it at all. It kept running, and the refs never went. They didn't go back and look at it. Like, I think David Shaw was...
First off, how dare you suggest Pac-12 officials might make a mistake? But second off, I think we would have heard about that by now.
He was upset. David Shaw was upset. Stop for a second.
David Shaw was upset that they were allowing the Huskies to substitute, even though Stanford didn't sub.
There were a lot of questionable things that happened on that.
Without seeing the old 22 tape, I don't...
But the clock kept ticking. They didn't even stop for a single second. It was just like... And it was a thing. It's like, whatever, it's the home clock. They're going to do what they're going to do. But the refs...
I don't know if that's even controlled by the...
Who do you think it's controlled by?
That might be controlled by the referee whistle. I'm not sure about that one. I guess it probably isn't because you have to ask to reset the clock. But... I think the referees would have noticed if that happened. I'm very skeptical.
Go watch the tape.
And we didn't hear anything about it after the game. Very skeptical.
Okay.
Lastly, on Husky football, Coach Pete said during this week's bye week press conference that Trey Adams returning for his fifth year is, quote, the plan. So that's good news, I think. Maybe not for Trey Adams.
Yeah, it's good news. I mean, honestly, Trey Adams needs to prove to NFL teams at this point that he can stay healthy. And he could go to the NFL and probably still would be drafted within the first four rounds or so. But if he wants to get back to being a first or second round pick, I think he needs a full healthy season.
Let's wrap up with the Seahawks coming off their 25-17 loss to the LA Chargers and preparing to face LA's other team, the Rams. You were at this game, the first Seahawks game that you or anyone else has attended in a very long period of time because of their road trip sandwiched around the bye. Takeaways from attending this game.
You wanting me to complain about the crowd here?
if that's what you want to do.
Takeaways from attending the game?
Just, okay, takeaways from the game, which I only saw the first quarter of and then was following on Twitter after that.
I want to talk about those at the end.
All right. Let's start with Seahawks topics. Chargers' massive advantage in this game in yards per play, 7.5 yards per play to 4.7 for the Seahawks. It's kind of amazing that it was as close as it was with the Seahawks having a chance to tie potentially on their final possession, given that stat.
When you look at and the reason it's like that is because the Chargers had so many explosive plays. They were very all or nothing offense. Because, I mean, Philip Rivers only had a 50% completion percentage in this game.
It was his lowest completion percentage of the season.
So there were a lot of explosive plays that happened, and that's kind of what got it there, but also sort of what kept the game relatively close.
8 plays of 20-plus yards for the Chargers, the most against the Seahawks this season. And there were 4 runs of 20-plus yards in there, 3 of them by Melvin Gordon, I think one of them by Keenan Allen. That's as many as the Seahawks had allowed previously all season.
I did not expect that to happen.
Me neither. They allowed 4 plays. Wait a minute. Allowed 4 plays of 20-plus yards in the previous 2 wins combined over Oakland and Detroit. So, I mean, there was definitely an element of the defense regressing to the mean, but they actually like played well in terms of like success rate, but the expected points added because of the big plays was pretty substantial for the Chargers.
Yeah, it was a weird game for the Husky or for the Seahawks defense.
I mean, by the way, the Huskies played a very Seahawks-y game.
They're kind of molding into the same team. Yeah. It's not fun. They're molding into a team that no one likes to watch.
At least Russell Wilson ran for a bunch of yards.
Yeah,
he did some green grass between the two of them.
It was a weird game for the Seahawks defense. Like I didn't look at it and say, wow, they played a terrible game. Because in the end, they made kind of enough plays, keep it relatively close. They got that stop at the end of the game, which...
I did not expect them to get that stop.
Really?
Which is why I liked the decision to onside kick. I know there was some debate about
that. Was that even an onside kick? That's the thing.
I don't know. I've never seen it. I'm just relying on what I go on Twitter. I literally did not watch that.
It was a very strange onside kick.
Okay.
It was not like... Being at the game, it was unclear exactly what the deal was. But maybe it was just a bad onside kick. I don't know. They need Dixon out there drop kicking it.
Oh, of course. In any scenario, the answer is Michael Dixon drop kick. Generate more offense, Michael Dixon drop
first kick. And goal for the one.
Michael Dixon drop kick field goal.
Getting that stop there, though, was pretty huge. The sack on third down was pretty huge. Coming up with those stops, I thought Bobby Wagner played an excellent game. The plays like the Keenan Allen on an end around or whatever was so much space. And I said this last week, the Phillip Rivers offense, Phillip Rivers Chargers offense, which granted is more explosive now than it was 3 or 4 years ago, the last time we played the Chargers. They're going down the field a little bit more. It is the perfectly suited offense to play against the Seahawks. Phillip Rivers is the most terrifying quarterback in the NFL to me. We haven't seen Mahomes against the Seahawks. Who knows what that'll look like? But I would rather, if you told me on Sunday that the Seahawks were going to be playing the Patriots offense or whatever, I'd be like, would gladly accept that. Aaron Rodgers.
You know, the Patriots offense did some things against the Seahawks in the Super Bowl. I don't know if you remember that. They made some plays.
They haven't seen
Trey. I know everyone.
They haven't seen Trey Flowers yet. I know. That team didn't have Delano Hill out there.
The Chargers saw Trey Flowers and they raised Trey Flowers.
Oh, Trey Flowers had some nice plays.
He had some rookie moments as well.
But Phillip Rivers and that offense is horrifying to see the Seahawks play. The two scariest quarterbacks of the Seahawks to play are Matt Ryan and Phillip Rivers. Because those are the quarterbacks who are so good.
But you've just
good.
Seen Matt Ryan more against the Seahawks.
And he's been good every time.
The Seahawks did do a pretty good job against Brady in the 2016
All the like elite level quarterbacks the Seahawks have done well against and how good Phillip Rivers and Matt Ryan have played against them. Quarterbacks who are very good at, I don't want to say dinking and dunking, but just like finding receivers
taking
in the middle
what the
of the
defense
field.
Gives you?
Sure. Those quarterbacks scare me.
So you knew it didn't scare the LA Chargers at quarterback. It was Russell Wilson. Who had a down game, completing 2/3 of his passes, but for a season low 6.0 yards per attempt and throwing his second pick six of the season, also took 4 sacks in this game.
It wasn't a great day for us.
Nope.
And you know, people have talked extensively about the miss to Jaron Brown. You see it. There's a lot of passes that Russ just like, there's a third down to Tyler Lockett that he missed. There were just some throws that Russ normally makes that he'll probably make next time. I mean, he took credit for it or whatever, blame for it. And
he
said,
took credit for it.
He took responsibility for the passes and was like, we'll make them next time. He also, in the end, made a lot of very good throws. And like the ball to David Moore at the end of the game was right there. The ball to Nick Vinette was right there. He made a lot of very good decisions in the end. But still, there are a few throws that probably, had he made them, they wouldn't have been in that position.
I watched the Vinette throw, and even though I knew it was a touchdown, it still looked like it wasn't going to get through to me.
It's scary.
Part of the problem here was the Seahawks faced a tremendous number of third downs, 15, in fact, going 4 of 15 on those, though they did pick up 3 fourth downs all on the final TD drive that included the fourth down conversion to Vinette. And a lot of the problem here was that the Seahawks, Mike Davis averaged just 3.4 yards per carry on first and second down, taking over as the lead running back in the second half with Chris Carson sidelined due to injury after he had 5.6 yards per carry on first and second down, on or 5.6 yards per carry total on his five carries, and also then just 10 play action attempts for the Seahawks among their 40-plus dropbacks, a massive change from the successful offensive formula that we've seen the last 3 weeks here.
So, you know, I think the issues that happened in these plays have been pretty well covered before, you know, post-game, throughout the week, right? Stupid penalties that happened, close calls that happen, you know, penalties that maybe could have been called on third downs or whatever, just missing third downs, right?
Yep.
But the thing that hasn't been covered enough is this is what happens when you rely on unsustainable things.
Yep.
Like running the ball, like rush defense, the margins become slim for everything.
I was told that the Seahawks had completely defied expectations and that the season was a success because they moved up to sixth in DVOA.
But this is what happens when you rely on things like that, is if you have a one-dimensional offense, all of a sudden you're giving up on series if you get in these long plays. The Chargers don't do that.
Nope.
Because the Chargers can pass the ball. You know, the Chargers have a diverse... Chargers
do pass the ball, you mean?
The Chargers have a diverse offense where they have a bunch of different looks that they can throw at you. And when you only have one look that you can do, when there's no other gear, this is what happened.
Yep.
And so if you can't get past a couple of penalties, it's like teams have penalties. These things happen. And if you're only going to rely on unsustainable things like being able to run the ball on first and second down, games like this are going to happen.
All right, lastly, can we sort of welcome back an old friend? It's Malik Smith.
No, it's Troy Mayne Pope, who is back on the practice squad with Chris Carson banged up.
And Troy Mayne. The Seahawks needing depth at running back. A toast to that for sure. Welcome back, the young Pope, who's not quite as young as the last time he was here.
Were that we loved anything as much as the Seahawks loved players that used to play for them.
Oh, running backs that used to play for them. I mean, it is sad they could not bring back Bruce Irvin, who instead signed with his hometown Atlanta Falcons.
They gladly would have,
though.
Oh, 100%.
And as I would gladly would have. Would have been great.
Man, Barkevious Mingo looked kind of slow on some of those plays.
Let's talk about this weekend's matchup against the LA Rams, who the Seahawks played tough in Seattle. Low these, I guess, now 5 weeks ago.
Did we get play action stats, by the way, for the?
They were 6 of 8, I know, for like 10 yards per attempt. Danny Kelly had that.
I just died a little bit on the inside. but that's the thing. How many passing attempts did Russ have?
I think there was like 47 dropbacks, or so, is off the top of my head.
I know the pass to Doug down the sideline, basically the only successful long pass of the game, I don't think was play action. Okay. I'm pretty sure that was a straight drop back. But if that's the case, that's the other thing. And this is what we've been talking about over and over and over again, is that if the rushing game isn't successful, it's like if it's 3rd and 22, honestly, they're expecting a draw in that place because that's what you've done over and over and over again. Maybe you run play action on 3rd and 20, right? There's no rule against it.
I mean, it's probably not going to be very successful on 3rd and 20.
There's no reason not to try. It's going to be just as successful as picking up a first down as throwing the ball 10 yards is going to be, or of running a draw on 3rd and 20 is going to be.
I could pick up a lot of yards for that Michael Dixon punt. You just watch it there.
Michael Dixon also, that should be a note. Excellent game.
Awesome.
And that's why you can look at this and see that the Chargers gained so many more yards than the Seahawks did, but also the Seahawks kept it relatively close because the Chargers were gaining a lot of yards to get to the place where field wasn't equaled out.
You're telling me special teams exist? Someone tell the Huskies. 6 of 8.
Special teams are good.
You know, like 6 of 8 for 80 yards. I said Huskies, not Seahawks.
I know.
6 of 8 for 80 yards on play action for Russell Wilson in this game. So that was 10 yards per attempt. If you take those out of his other dropbacks, you're probably getting down to like 5 yards per attempt. So probably about double on the play action.
What is wrong with them?
What in the world? All right, again, let's talk about the Rams, who they lost a game. They lost to the Saints.
Yeah, we knew the Rams. All the talk of the Rams going. The
teams just don't go undefeated in the NFL. It's very hard to do.
Teams don't go undefeated in the NFL, and the Rams are not the 2007.
I mean, they're already, even by DVOA, the best team in the NFL right now.
Like
that being the Kansas City Chiefs.
The takes about the Rams were getting a little bit out of control, and honestly, they've been winning a lot of maybe too close games.
I mean, the Seahawks game, the Broncos game, those were both relatively you know, they were
the Packers
they were
game.
Losable.
They had like the Packers game, three in a row. Yeah. Basically, any time that they haven't played the Cardinals and the 49ers lately, they've been a pretty close game.
So you're feeling the Seahawks are going to win this week. That's your take. Still number 2 in offensive DVOA, 3rd in passing, and 2nd in rushing. The Rams have only been average in terms of pass blocking, as measured by Football Outsiders' adjusted sack rate this season, but the Seahawks did not sack Goff in the first meeting. You'll recall that Brandon Cooks did not have any catches in that first meeting as he dealt with a concussion suffered early in that game. Cooper Kupp also left with a concussion after going having six catches and 9 targets for 90 yards and a touchdown. Both of those players now back after the Rams really didn't skip much of a beat with Josh Reynolds stepping in at receiver.
Although those games that I said were probably closer than they should have been.
But like in
Cooper
terms
Kupp was not playing.
He wasn't, but the problem wasn't really their pass
it's
offense.
All on Cooper Kupp.
Yeah. Cooper Kupp for MVP.
Keenan Reynolds wasn't doing enough. They also lost the first game that Cooper Kupp played.
The Seahawks held Todd Gurley to 3.5 yards per carry, his second lowest total this season, average this season, in their first matchup. It would be good if they repeated that. I would endorse that.
If it weren't for whatever happened with Melvin Gordon last week, I would say it was almost a certainty. But now my entire faith in the Seahawks run defense has changed.
Wow, a lot of faith shaken this year in Seattle football. The Rams defense, I think, is actually the more legitimate question mark in those close wins, and then certainly cropped up in this loss last week, where Michael Thomas ate up Marcus Peters for 12 catches and 15 targets for 211 yards, including the 72-yard touchdown he celebrated by pulling Joe Horn's cell phone out of the pylon at the Superdome. The biggest issue I'd say for the Rams is that their pass rush has been pretty mediocre. They're 23rd in adjusted sack rate and did not sack Drew Brees last week. To try to improve that, they traded a third-round pick to Jacksonville for former number 3 overall pick Dante Fowler last week. He played 44 snaps against the Saints, had a tackle for loss and a pass deflection, but obviously did not have a sack in his LA Rams debut. And probably related to the lack of pass rush, they've struggled defending deep passes, ranking 23rd against those this season, according to Football Outsiders. The Seahawks, you'll recall, did a lot of damage with something called play action during the first meeting, particularly to Tyler Lockett, who had 3 catches and his 4 targets for 98 yards and a touchdown.
The thing about Chris Carson not playing is that it makes me nervous that they're not going
We're ruling out Chris Carson?
Well, okay. About there being a chance that Chris Carson doesn't play, is it means that there's a chance that they will not utilize play action as much.
I mean, it depends how successful they are. They also ran for 190 yards on 5.9 yards per carry in the first meeting. And the Rams overall have not been a very good run defense. They ranked 24th in DVOA against the run. They did stop New Orleans' run game pretty well last week. They only allowed 4.1 yards per carry. But overall this season, 4.65 yards per carry to opposing running backs.
Let's go, Mike Davis!
So I think there's a play-action chance. Also worth noting from last Sunday's game, counting the 2 fourth-down conversions they had, including one in a similar situation on 4th-and-1 at the end of the game to seal it, to both the one that the Huskies eschewed last Saturday, but also the one that the Rams picked up to seal their first game in Seattle. Counting those two, the Saints went 9 of 12 in terms of converting when they got to third down, punted, I believe, just once, maybe twice in this game.
So you're saying that if the Seahawks offense is as good as the Saints offense at home, they'll have a chance to win?
It'll be a close game. Okay. Yeah. The Rams special team is probably slightly better than they were against the Seahawks due to injuries. Of course, Greg Zuerlein is back. He's been gone 7 of 8 on field goals since his return, having missed a 51 yarder last week. The Rams went 7 of 10 on field goals in his absence and ranked 29th this season, according to Football Outsiders, and expected points added on place kicks. Also, they get back JoJo Natson, who is averaging 14.9 yards per punt return. He did not play in the first meeting due to injury.
It's been one of the coolest things about so far, in the parlance of Pete Carroll, is that the special teams has gotten much better, though.
Yes.
I mean, partially...
Well, it's only because of Michael Dixon.
Partially because of Michael
Dixon. All just fine.
They're still making tackles on special teams, though.
They're fine.
I mean, they're not the Huskies. Like, they're down there covering these punts also.
By the way, shout out to Kyler Gordon getting some action in what is going to be his redshirt freshman season. A really nice tackle to actually stop Stanford inside the top 20, inside their own 20, which apparently is allowed.
Wow. But it is nice seeing the Seahawks kind of become a more balanced team than they've been in the past. Well, than they were last year. They've actually been one of the most balanced teams in the past. But kind of moving a little bit more towards that place again.
Yes.
And having something where you can see that there's maybe even a bit of an advantage against the Rams.
Yes. Anything else to discuss about this matchup before we get to chances of victory? Do you have a vision of this?
I'm probably too optimistic.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm always too optimistic. I'm holding on. I have not given
up. You're always 5% too optimistic.
I haven't given up hope on this game.
Oh, should we note, by the way, that the Seahawks are 10-point underdogs in this game. Their largest, they have been the largest by which the other team has been favored in the Russell Wilson era, I believe.
I mean, that makes sense. Of all games, this would be the one playing against one of the best teams in the NFL in their home. But if the Seahawks can run the ball anywhere near the way that they ran the ball against the Rams at home, this will probably be a close game. Much closer than that point margin. But the Rams offense, it's just too much. It's such an onslaught. Even the Saints saw it. Like, the Saints eventually stopped them at various times. But, like, when I think the Saints were up, like, 27 at some point, it was instant that the Rams tied the game. And it just keeps, like, seeing the amount of points that were being scored in that game was expected. And I don't know if any team can stop the Rams. And I just don't. I don't necessarily see the Seahawks being the ones. Like, we slowed them down last time, and they scored 33 points. So, oh, that was the other thing about, I was going to say, that relying on unsustainable things, like turnovers also.
Yes.
So this is what happens when you rely on unsustainable things like turnovers. And it was just like Pete Carroll kept talking about it. It's like, dude, like, really? Turnovers, first off, you know what it's like to go on a very long turnover drought, being the head coach of the Seahawks. Like, they had seasons where they didn't get that many turnovers. So this coming as a shock to you that in one random game they didn't get a turnover. It's like, this is not a sustainable thing. It's not a predictable thing. If you get a turnover, you're lucky.
I mean, it's not entirely luck, but it's very noisy, so...
And that's the thing. If you're relying on unsustainable things like turnovers as a defense, it's games like that are going to happen. Maybe sometimes you're going to get them, but who knows? And if in this Rams game they don't, like they did in Seattle, the Rams might, instead of winning by 3, be winning by 14.
Yes.
So, because if they would have scored field goals or touchdowns in those drives, that game isn't as close as it ended up being. Maybe it'll happen. I don't know. I think the offense will play well. I think the Seahawks will put up in this game. You know, kind of the era of going to LA and having these like brutal like 12-6 games or whatever where the Seahawks can't run any offense probably is over. I'm going to knock on wood when I say that.
I mean, I would say that like the negative scenario for this game, the Rams go march up and down the field as they are wont to do. The Seahawks miss some third downs their first couple drives, and they're behind 14-0, and they decide they can no longer play action because they're behind in the game.
Yes.
Which is a relatively similar script to what played out in this Chargers game, but
I mean, they had so many drives in that third quarter against the Chargers where it's like, you got to start doing it. You weren't watching this, but it was like, the third quarter is like, eventually the offense kind of has to start happening. You know, and they waited until there were two drives left. And that's the thing about Stanford. Stanford didn't wait. Stanford started running the offense early, and things went well for them.
Not early enough. Not early enough.
They had a pretty big deficit.
They did.
Huh. But, you know, maybe they're able to pick up turnovers, though. Maybe they get a kickoff that is fumbled or something, score a touchdown, then fumble the kickoff like they did in Detroit. And all of a sudden, you're in a pretty good position.
Right.
But do I expect them to win?
Well, that's what we do chances of victory for.
15%.
That you think is too optimistic? I mean, it's still an NFL game. There's still a lot of unpredictability.
I feel too optimistic.
Okay. Because I was going to say 25%.
25%?
Yeah.
You think there's a 1 in 4 chance? You think that this game is played 4 times that the Seahawks won one of those 4?
I mean, it's just hard to have that high a win probability in the NFL. Teams aren't that different from each other. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head what the 10... Oh, it's down to 9.5 now, the line.
There we go.
Oh. That's a totally different thing.
People are pounding the Seahawks.
Let's see. The Seahawks are plus 400. So that would imply a 20%. Maybe a little bit before, better than 20%. Yeah. So, okay. I'll go down to 20%. So
we have our there usual we go. I've talked you out of that 25%.
You did. You talked me down.
But I still feel optimistic. And it's like, maybe they could...
I never really understand. Your percentage is, you're at 80%, but you're nervous. You're 15%, you're optimistic. I just can't.
This is how I'm able to say that I correctly have predicted every game.
Exactly.
No, that's not actually true. We just go by the way I feel about it instead of the actual percentage chance. I don't know if I felt right about the games this last weekend.
Yeah.
But I think there's a chance. I don't know.
Of course there's a chance. It's the just NFL.
Watching the Rams play.
Is literally any given Sunday.
They just haven't been that impressive looking, especially.
Yeah. And they also have been playing. I mean, they've been playing on the road or against better teams. I guess the Packers aren't maybe a better team than the Seahawks.
They've had to start doing things to get Todd Gurley the ball into space, like passing to him out of the backfield, which honestly they weirdly don't like to do as much as they should. But if they can completely shut Todd Gurley down as a runner and kind of force the Rams to be completely one-dimensional, you know, maybe they'll get a stop or two.
All right, we'll see.
Yeah.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.